But good evening, this is Paul Kelly, and you are listening to World Tour on KABF 88.3. Speak Up Arkansas is a chance for you to listen to and involve yourself with discussions about policy and things that affect your community. And I want to start off with by reading a letter to the editor that just happened to see the earlier this week, and it really speaks to what we're getting ready to talk about. It is a Bill Owens letter to the editor. I think he's a pretty frequent contributor, and it reads like this. The preamble of the Constitution states, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to and our posterity. We do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." In 1828, Webster's English Dictionary has the following definition of welfare: a good faring, exemption from misfortune, sickness, calamity, or evil, the enjoyment of health and the common blessings of life, prosperity, and happiness apply to all persons. This is what, and this letter was written in support of the need to talk about health care, and the current health care debate is just one example of how state and national governments battle with their role in helping citizens or promoting the general welfare of the community. When too many families can't afford a safe house, utilities, food, or reliable transportation, what should the government do? Let the market forces take care of it? Let the churches deal with it? Or just look away? Isn't it just an individual problem caused by making poor decisions? In the studio today to discuss the appropriate role of government in promoting the general welfare of citizens struggling to enjoy health and the common blessings of life, peace, and prosperity are Jay Barth, a political science professor at Hendricks College, and Daniel Greenberg, president of the Advance Arkansas Institute. We did invite just Dr. Joseph Jones, but he had a last-minute issue with his family and were not able to join us. Jay, I'm glad to have you here in the studio with us, and thank you for being here. And Daniel, thank you for coming and joining us.
It's an honor to be here.
All right. Well, Jay, I know you teach political science, and so this is really sort of a political science question, one that when I was at Advocates, I always liked to ask legislators because it enabled me to figure out where they were coming from as far as working with these families. So what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, and I think it's more a political theory question than an empirical question, although I think there's some empirical evidence that may provide us some insights on which path pays off for certain individuals in society. I do think it really is a pretty fundamental normative question of whether we see society as a collection of individuals who are fairly autonomous and really have the responsibility to kind of take care of themselves as free folks, or whether we really are part of a community. And whether, as part of a community, we have some duty to be sure that those in our community do have a certain level of equality, so that they can really have the greatest opportunity of thriving over the long haul. I think that in this country, government becomes our primary, but not only, force for enhancing those communitarian ideals that we have a basic responsibility to take care of one another.
Sir.
I do think that, you know, in the United States, going back to soon after the founding, we've also put a great deal of responsibility in civil society and nonprofit organizations to also aid in that work. But I think we also have to be clear that there are certain limitations on nonprofits. Moreover, that they're not going to be able to hit all of the needs as fully as possible. But I do think that from my perspective, we are all better off if we have really kind of bought into that notion that we have some duty to take care of everyone, at least providing a basic equality of opportunity. And I think in particular for the youngest members of society and the folks at the other end of their lifespan, and those who are disabled and otherwise unable to kind of always take care of themselves, that responsibility gets ratcheted up, and because we all know that there are individuals in the society who really don't have the capability to fend for themselves in a society in which there is this ongoing kind of a challenge at the individual level.
Uh-huh. So the common good is yeah. part of what we do.
Right.
I think we're often criticized sometimes that government steps in too much. Part of the perspective, too, is that, well, part of government is to step in when all else is failing. And do you think some of the things that have and made the country turn towards investing in Social Security and health care and Medicare, those kinds of things, are a result of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think government at a bare minimum has a responsibility to step in and take care of in situations where things are failing. But I think government also, using good research and good evidence, can make some choices to prevent those failures from ever happening in the first place, from stepping in, intervening before we reach that point that folks are really in particular dire straits, and that we have learned enough lessons over the long haul to know when some intervention is actually going to pay off for society and for those individuals who may be in particularly challenging circumstances.
Well, where does common good begin and socialism end or whatever?
And I think that I'm very clear. I think we're all many are very clear that government can't do it all. That makes life a lot less interesting if we have that kind of circumstance where everything is kind of taken care of by government. But we do have a duty to be sure that in as efficient and effective way as possible, the community steps up and takes care of those individuals. And I do think that government is the most efficient and effective way of being sure that. That all folks do get that kind of basic care.
Okay. All right. Daniel, tell us a little bit about the institute you're with. So
the Advance Arkansas Institute is an organization I helped start up a few years ago, and our idea is that we want to work with the public and work with legislators to advance a perspective of lower taxes and more individual freedom and a government that's characterized by openness and integrity and that creates a low tax burden. So speaking generally, we're in favor of free markets and limited government. And I was really, I thought Professor Barth said so many things that were so interesting, and it struck me that many of the issues that he raises are really kind of settled by the preamble to the Constitution. You know, Professor Barth said, you know, there's sometimes there's a tension or a question about whether we're just a group of separated, atomized individuals, or whether the goal of American government is to provide something for everyone. And I think, you know, the preamble to the Constitution kind of answers that, because the role, right, of government is to promote the general welfare as well as to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our children. And I think that I agree with Professor Barth that we need to be very careful about looking at the real world, looking at facts and looking at evidence to try to figure out how we're going to advance the general welfare and to make sure that everyone has liberty. And so if you look at history, I mean, you can see that sometimes we've done a great job of providing the things we need to everyone, and sometimes we've done a terrible job. And I fear that sometimes it's really kind of the heavy footprint of government that's implicated when we see just kind of a disastrous provision of services to people. So I'm happy to talk about that when it's time.
Uh-huh. Well, I would like for you to talk a little bit about what you perceive as the role of government or how you think it's working so far, or the things that you're concerned about.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that in several areas. I mean, I think it's fair to say that when we look at how America has done in higher education, then America is really kind of the envy of the world in higher education. I mean, just about any kind of need you have, any kind of degree you want, there's a way for people to get it in America. America is the envy of the world when it comes to higher education. Now, our public education system, our K-12 education system, I think it's also fair to say we're not the envy of the world. There's a lot of improvements that can be made. And this probably has something to do with the GI Bill, when people came back from World War II and they were essentially given a big checkbook, and the GI Bill said, you can go wherever you want, and here's how we're going to pay for it. We're going to give you a checkbook. That's what the GI Bill was. And of course, what we don't have anything like that in K-12 today. I mean, most people don't have any choice in where they want to go. And so when we start thinking about what the ideal system is for provision of education at K-12 level, it probably needs to look a little bit more like America's higher education system. We probably need to have more choice and more opportunity for experimentation, because I just don't see how public schools, the way they're currently instantiated, are going to provide an ideal environment for every student. Families need choice in education, and I think most people favor more choice in education. And so that's a kind of reform that involves personal choice that I think is very important for really the advancement of humanity. I think probably, you talked a little bit about what we need to do, what social measures we need to take in order to advance people's welfare. And goodness, I mean, I tend to think that history has certain lessons, and if there's any lesson about advancing people who are downtrodden and advancing their prospects, I mean, it's got to have something to do with encouraging free markets and a free society. I mean, goodness, just look at places like Hong Kong or places like Taiwan. 50 or 100 years ago, these places were essentially nothing but dirt, and there haven't been any huge spending programs in those countries. What happened is that they let free markets and the protection of private property and the rule of law essentially make everyone richer. I mean, if you want to look at huge changes in human welfare, you look at those countries and you can see huge changes, huge advancements in human welfare. And you can look at the United States, and you can see that there are areas where we don't respect those kinds of freedoms, those kinds of property rights. I mean, if you look at, for instance, one way that government raises revenue, which is civil forfeiture. Are you familiar with civil forfeiture at all?
Well, I know they're...
I hate to divert from I hope I'm not taking too long talking about this stuff.
Well, you can... I was just thinking about the police taking cars and stuff away
yes.
from people. Yeah.
So that's what civil forfeiture is. People taking... government agents taking your property without criminal convictions. And we reached a milestone in American civilization this last year, which is that cops took more stuff through civil forfeiture, more dollars through civil forfeiture, than thieves took through burglary. We had kind of a new record in civil forfeiture, and civil forfeiture typically falls most heavily on poor and minority communities. Mm-hmm. And so that's a way in which I think the United States has done a terrible job of respecting people's rights and taking people's rights seriously. So I think that obviously if you had a stronger system of protection of people's rights, and if we took more care to not to take stuff from people and protected their rights a little bit more, I think that'd be a great advancement for civilization.
But I think there reaches a point, though, where as part of a governmental regulation, I mean, there ultimately has to be some infringement upon personal autonomy. And I think those who would advocate so far as to say that any governmental regulation is a taking of property, I think is basically and leads us to an incredibly chaotic situation. I mean, if we think about the ways in which we basically need to have some societal norms, mm-hmm. that involves some limitations on what folks can do with their property, what folks can do in their daily lives, and for some who treat every regulation as an invasion of property, I think that just reaches a point where it's impossible to govern at all. And I think that's where things go too much. And I think the takings revolution in the U.S. Supreme Court has really led us to a potential where it makes it very difficult to regulate the environment in other key ways.
You know, I was looking at the Heritage Foundation, and one of the title was Trump Can Help Poor Americans by Identifying Big Government Policies That Hurt. And one of them was consider credit availability. Poorer Americans often have only one option for overcoming cash flow problems to meet financial obligations, payday loans. However, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau may make these short-term loans a thing of the past. You know, those are $1,500 a year interest rates on payday loans. They say they had to acknowledge that it's proposed, Consumer Protection Agency's proposal payday lending rule would effectively destroy the industry, eliminating 85% of the loans currently made. More than 12 million people per year use short-term loans. So is this really a good way to help the poor by offering them interest rates for small loans that end up being $1,500% interest? Because we just did away with them in Arkansas, and I worked on that. And yes, the fact of the matter is they do have other ways of getting money. They turn to payday loans. They're so well sold, they're so well presented, and they're so false in their presentation to the people that they sound like it's going to be a piece of cake. So how does that is that sound like a good policy to you?
Well, I mean, I think you raise an interesting issue. And I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that there are some people who are not very good at handling their finances and who are going to make mistakes. But, you know, I mean, I also don't think there's any doubt that some people they will occasionally have a need for a loan on a pretty immediate basis. And they are best situated to make up their own minds about the kinds of financial options they need. And as a general matter, you know, most people are not going to be helped by removing one of their options. And so a payday loan is a pretty tough decision. But, I mean, I can imagine some situations where a high interest rate loan could be helpful. I don't know enough about that market about that industry to say that that kind of interest rate really could ever be appropriate. But I mean, the larger point really is it's hard to see how you're going to help people by taking away their options. I mean, the only logical, if you believe that you really are helping people by taking away their options, I mean, the only logical conclusion is, you know, there are just a whole lot of people who have no idea how to take care of themselves and how to handle their own financial affairs, which is at some level kind of insulting. I mean, I do think, I mean, putting aside the question of payday loans for a second, I mean, I think there's no question that the role of government really I think the government has taken away options from a whole lot of people. I mean, for instance, when you look at the growth of licensure, you know, which is, you know, what allows you to work, you know, only 5% of the U.S. labor force required a license to work 50 years ago. Now a quarter of the labor force needs a license to work. You know, licenses are really hard to get. Both Professor Barth and I have advanced degrees. It's tough to get an advanced degree, and sometimes even tougher to get a license. But I mean, there's no question that the overregulation of the American economy has really taken opportunity away from a lot of people in a way that just wasn't true 50 years ago.
But Dan, I think you have to recognize that the economy has become more complex across those 50 years. We have much more specialized jobs that folks are carrying out. And I think that we also have, certain of those jobs that can really do others harm, either in their physical life or are in their psychological life or in a variety of other ways if there are abuses of folks. And so I think that, I'm pretty happy that the physician that I see is licensed.
Sure.
You probably are.
But they were licensed 50 years ago.
They are too.
Yes.
But I think it's also not bizarre to ask some of these more specialized, nuanced careers that have grown up to show some level of not only ability to perform the job, but also some responsibility to continue to develop professionally across that time. I mean, I think we ask that of teachers, and I think that's an appropriate question for them to engage in the ongoing professional development that they need so that they can continue to perform as best as possible. We have given more freedom to what kind of professional development that is, and I think that's an important path to go for innovative purposes. But I do think it's not unfathomable and not bizarre to ask folks in these specialized careers to actually show that they have the basic capabilities.
Yeah, I want to remind folks that you can call in at 501-433-0088. We welcome you to this discussion. You can also send an email to speakupar@gmail.com and put your question or comment on an email. So again, 501-433-0088. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want to focus again. Let's talk about low-income people and those in particular. I mean, payday lending is certainly something that affects them. When I was I started reading this thing from Trump can do to help poor Americans. I thought, well, what about dealing with the criminal justice system, which you brought up? I mean, we've got a jail. We are sending millions of people. I think it's like if our system of incarceration were a city, it would be larger than Houston. There are like 3 or 4 million people in prison across the country. And then we have people who, and then we had the downturn of the economy where everybody lost their shirt and everything else and nobody went to jail. And if you are a company that violates some safety or human risk or do fraudulent things, you don't go to jail. You pay some sort of a fine, and then you turn around and put it on your tax return and deduct it as a business expense. Now, tell me that isn't a role of government in keeping people poor.
Well, I want to speak to that. If I could, I want to try to respond to that question and also respond to Professor Barth by talking about a couple of things that happened in the legislature this last session. Because I noticed that one of the attempts that was made was to get rid of the certification requirement for drug counselors and substitute a license requirement that would have eliminated drug counselors who had any kind of serious criminal background. Now, it seems to me that many drug counselors are going to have, I hate to say this, but I mean, surely it's true. Many drug counselors go into this business and are probably benefited perhaps by some rather unseemly conduct in the past. And I think we have to be very careful about this move to say that all these people who are doing fairly complex work have to have a, you know, a clean criminal background for the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, I think you can be a perfectly capable worker if you've made a mistake, you know, a decade or two ago. I think you can be a perfectly effective worker. And this epidemic of licensure that we've had over the last couple of decades, which again, I mean, has increased the portion of licensed workers in the United States by something like 400 or 500%. I mean, it makes it very, very difficult for people of modest means who to start up their own business to get a job. Similarly, I certainly appreciate that licensure is appropriate in some contexts, but I mean, Arkansas is one of the most heavily burdened licensure states. I mean, for instance, if you want to get a job or you want to start up a business as a drywall installer, you know, somebody who puts up drywall in houses, you have to have 5 years worth of experience in Arkansas in order to start up your own business. And I appreciate that putting up drywall is hard work, but I think you could probably be a perfectly capable drywall installer with significantly less than 5 years of experience. I mean, putting up drywall requires a strong back and some discipline. I mean, I don't really think it doesn't require the same sort of intense years of study as it does to get a PhD. You know, you'd probably be a pretty darn good drywall installer after a month or two on the job. And so when we look at this epidemic of licensure, I think it has a lot to do with incumbents in the market trying to freeze competitors out, trying to keep prices high, and trying to block other people who want to better themselves to start up their own businesses from entering the market. And so I don't just think it has to do with public safety. I think it has everything to do with self-interested special interest groups who want to block poor people from having the same opportunity that incumbent businesses have. And I think a big part of that is pointless and overly heavy restrictions on people who have made a serious mistake in judgment 20 or 30 years ago and still have a criminal record to prove it.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's a different issue. I mean, our way in which we push out of the economy and push out of kind of key aspects of life, folks, for what in many cases are youthful juvenile offenses, mm-hmm. That are nonviolent in nature, I think is crazy and inegalitarian. And so I agree in many respects. I do think that in addition, you know, Arkansas, because it has such low taxes in other areas, does overly rely on fees from licensures for some of its income for resources for certain programs. So I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think if I know Dan will disagree about the way in which our tax structure is given, but it is certainly one that is it has its challenges as a tax system. I think on the licensure issue, though, in general, I do think that we do need to ask the question: are these criteria necessary to protect folks and to be sure that these folks are not only capable of doing the job, but continuing to grow in their profession as those professions that in some cases are pretty highly specialized do change across time.
You're listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and you're welcome to chime in. We're going to take a short break here, think about a little bit about what you've heard and think of a question or a comment to make, and you can call us after the break at 501-433-0088, and we'll take your call or email me at speakupar@gmail.com. We'll be back in just a minute.
Agarirara, agarirara munkolimbo. Agarirara, agarirara munkolimbo. Okogera njogera omweru takira muddugavu. Agarirara, agarirara munkolimbo. Nakamwante tagenze kumbugo kundopa senakola ntya agalirala munkolimbo agalirala agalirala munkolimbo agalirala agalirala munkolimbo
Kogira njogira nsuwe yogira noruendo Agalirala Agalirala mkolimbo Agalirala Agalirala mkolimbo Agalirala Agalirala mkolimbo Agalirala mkolimbo Okogira njogira omweru takira mudugavu Agalirala Agalirala mkolimbo Agalirala Agalirala mkolimbo Agalirala Agalirala mkolimbo
All right, welcome back to Speak Up Arkansas. Again, give us a call here, 501-433-0088. Has government had any impact on your life, negative or positive? Are there some things that you'd like to see changed or issues that you think the government should take or get out of the way so that low-income people can thrive and prosper in this country? Daniel, I read a article from Patrick Gary, who's with Renew America, and said the right deal, the conservative anti-poverty approach. Conservative policy should seek to ensure that no one who works full-time and heads a household lives in poverty. But this can be done better through a targeted anti-poverty program than a minimum wage increase. The earned income tax credit is an effective anti-poverty program because it targets household income, provides an incentive for people to work because it is only offered to working households. This was presented to the legislature this last session. Warwick Sabin did an amazing job at offering that. Advocates has asked that as a issue for as long as I've been there. It was started by Nixon and Reagan, or whoever touted it as the best poverty-fighting program they've ever put forth. And yet, we can't get it passed in Arkansas. Is that something your group was interested in or would work on with
I'm not sure I agree with that assessment. I mean, as you know, the way the EITC works is it's not just that it it's not just that it cuts taxes in the way that a typical conservative tax policy does. What it does is it gets the government to send you a check. And so it can best be understood, I think, as a kind of subsidy. And again, my view is that you want to have regulatory policies that encourage openness in the labor market and encourage work. And I mean, you know, we talked a little bit about the drywall installers first. I mean, I don't think that's an isolated example in Arkansas. I mean, Arkansas has some of the heaviest restrictions on employment of any of the states. I don't know if you're aware of this. You have to have, for instance, 730 days of experience and training in order to serve as a teacher's assistant in Arkansas. Most states don't require anything like that. Most states don't have that kind of requirement. And it doesn't seem plausible to me that you really have to have 730 days in order to be a good teacher's assistant. I think it's possible. I mean, I can think of some people who'd be pretty darn good teacher's assistants, you know, who's the person who's like the second in command in the primary school classroom. It's possible you could have pretty darn good teacher's assistants right off the street, you know, maybe a day or two worth of training. But 730 days for being a teacher's assistant? Most states allow someone to pursue this kind of occupation with no experience or training requirement at all. And we have a lot of requirements like that. We have really some of the most burdensome in the nation. And I think open labor markets that allow people to work, that allow people to pursue their dreams. Again, I don't really think that a lot of these requirements have anything to do with health or safety. I think they have to do with shutting down labor markets. Okay. Is an earned income tax credit the way to go? I mean, gosh, I would say that if we really want to have conservative tax policy, we ought to have a policy that lets people keep more money in their pocket. And I happen to pull up some statistics here from a paper that we're about to publish. And it seems to me that these statistics explain why it's hard to have capital come to Arkansas, and it's a lot easier for other states to attract investment capital. We have the 17th highest tax rate, Arkansas, in the nation. We're surrounded by Louisiana, which has the 45th highest, Mississippi that has the 41st highest, Oklahoma that has the 40th highest, Tennessee that has the 47th highest, and Texas has the 46th highest in terms of a per capita percentage tax burden. And I guess I'm sure there are different ways to calculate this and different understandings of it. But when you have this, when you have a tax burden that's more like New York's or California's tax burden here in Arkansas, you can see why Arkansas doesn't attract people, and you can see why jobs and capital and investments leave Arkansas and go to other places. And so I think that's a conservative tax policy, to have lower taxes for everyone.
Well, but earned income tax credit actually has been proven to work to bring people out of poverty. You talked about the ability of the VA or the veterans to fuel higher education. Why couldn't we fuel getting out of poverty by offering financial incentives when people get up and go to work every day and are making less money than they can to make ends meet? If it works. I mean, that's what, you know, there are some policies that don't work, but this one does. So
I think that, you know, I mean, we saw it work so well in the aftermath of the 1996 welfare reform, where the earned income tax credit was ratcheted up. And it is those folks who are barely making it, but who are working every day, that benefit from it, and their kids benefit from it. And moreover, it has an economic positive economic effect, because those folks have so little to save that they immediately put that back into the economy. And so it is actually a great engine for economic growth, as well as transforming the lives of individuals. I think, a couple other things that just to respond to things Daniel said. I mean, I think that there is a belittling tone in the way in which you talk about teachers' assistants, for instance. And I think in terms of the training that is appropriate to be sure that folks can manage a classroom appropriately, the training that is appropriate to be sure that our those who are caretaking for our kids have the ethical training and know where the proper lines are in terms of how to behave in the classroom, you know, that doesn't come from somebody off the street. That is something where it is appropriate to give some folks training so that they are ready to do right, and moreover, more likely to stay in the classroom once they're there if they actually are well trained. Because we know that one of the things that really pushes people out oftentimes is not feeling that they have the tools they need to really thrive. And finally, on the tax burden in Arkansas, I think it is so important to recognize that the poverty that exists in the state means that we do need more in the way of resources to be sure that we can respond to the needs of the people of the state. This is a poor state. It has been since its origins. It is necessary that we have more resources put in to be sure that this state is able to take care of those who suffer from some of those lingering decades of poverty.
Now, the intergenerational nature of poverty cannot be overemphasized, and how that is set into almost on a cellular level a pattern of behavior and attitudes and, you know, physical abilities to do things. And if we just sit, how can, you know, I mean, those are long-term and immediate. You have to address the immediate. And I can tell you that I was listening to the radio the other day. I wanted to keep this quote. Yeah, it was some African-American man who had been impoverished from struggling families, who ended up being very successful. And they called him an exception. He said, "I'm not an exception to the rule. I was just exposed to exceptional opportunities." And there was a, I think it was a Harvard and Heritage and RAN and a whole bunch of other foundations got together. It was over a year ago, and talked about how they should address poverty and come together, liberal versus conservative. And the one thing they agreed on was you can't start holding people accountable until they've had opportunities. How can you hold somebody accountable if all their opportunities were food, drugs, you know, selling drugs, or going hungry, or, you know, I mean, they are in situations that where there's no good options for them in communities and in families and in circumstances where they don't have good options. And we as government and as people don't really seem to intervene or ask government to do anything until after the problems have arisen. What about thinking about identifying those who are vulnerable and doing something to intercede so that we don't end up with everybody in prison, we don't end up with divorces where single mothers are raising kids, and all the things that end up being a part of the structure that is contributing to poverty. I wanted to read again from this Right Deal. Apparently, this is a conservative you don't agree with. A true anti-poverty agenda must promote strong families. Married two-income couples, even those earning only the minimum wage, are unlikely to fall into poverty, and children growing up in such families are just as unlikely to be poor. Larger, refundable child tax credits applicable to both income and payroll taxes, and even saving incentives for couples of modest means, would relieve some of the financial pressures that tear apart marriages. That is a suggestion, again, of taking families who are struggling and put a policy in there to prevent them from tipping over. Because they are, and it's almost like the earned income tax credit again. It's rewarding people who are staying together. It is rewarding people who are working, who are living on the edge, with a way and an incentive to increase their savings and their financial well-being. What's wrong
with
that?
So I guess the idea is if somebody has a stable marriage, a two-parent family, some government body's going to write them a check. Am I understanding that right?
No, they are.
I mean, what's the incentive getting, you're referring to?
Well, they're talking about the problem with marginally families who are not in the federal poverty level, but they're paying an awful lot of money for child care.
Yes, yes.
And this is to reimburse them for something that is critical to their child's long-term well-being, and so they need some help with that. It's a tax credit. What do you think about that as a method for?
So, this is an area I don't know all that much about, but I think that we do have already some kind of child care tax credit in Arkansas and on the federal level.
The size of the child tax care credit is low relative to the average cost of child care and has not been expanded since 1980.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think we've just seen dramatic inflation when it comes to high quality child care in particular. And I think that, you know, there are varying forms of child care.
I don't know what that is.
I thought that was a caller calling in with a question.
Well, I don't see a light going on. So, okay, a comment and question. A common argument by conservatives against a government-managed health care system is that it is socialized medicine. What I don't understand is Canada, France, the UK, Germany, some have a form of government-managed health care. Those countries have a much more cost-effective system, and their health outcomes are better, while cost and health measures in the U.S. are worsening. What about that? I mean, there is a pushback, and this is sort of how we, the argument du jour right now is about health care.
Right. So I mean, I think that some of that is not true, right? Because, I mean, for instance, it's pretty clear that in England, there's a move to deny people who are obese many types of health care benefits, perhaps on some sort of theory of being punitive, or that these people are sort of responsible for their obesity or something like that. I mean, I think that you can see rationing in many of these countries. I certainly don't think it's true that when you compare like to like, when you use the correct yardstick, that we have a health problem in the United States on a dollar for dollar basis. Now it is true, right, that different countries use different yardsticks, and the United States will often use heroic measures to help premature, preemie babies, prematurely born babies, and so we spend a lot more resources in the United States on those than in many countries, and so that jiggers the numbers somewhat. But if you take that away, we do very well on health indicators.
Although I do, I do think we do spend an awful lot of money on paperwork, and that obviously is streamlined in those countries. I do think that, we're hitting at a point. I mean, I think I do get a little frustrated at times with these, Canada versus England versus U.S. comparisons, in that I think they are, we do have different cultural norms around healthcare. I think that's important to consider. I think the even if you agree with the basic dollars and cents arguments, I think there are some problems. I do think that we also have to, whether we love it or not, we have to appreciate the fact that a private health insurance. Private health insurance has grown up as a norm in American life, mostly based on insurance received from private employers. We know that's a reality. It is very difficult to undo that genie once it's out of the bottle, the way that in other countries, more socialized forms of health care were created earlier on, and that was not created. I think as President Obama said, even if a single payer is the ideal, it is very difficult to undo the development of a full-fledged private insurance set of norms that have grown up over time.
They wanted to point out that those citizens in those other countries are engaged in strong political systems in which they have individual liberty, vote, and have a strong voice in public policy, own private property. They don't seem to be going down a slippery slope to communism. And here's another one. It seems some needs of society are better met by public management. One example is water and electricity utilities. Why not health care? I mean, there's a row of government in the common water, the health, the air, although I think some people would be arguing right now about how they're doing on providing electricity, and a little resistant to innovative ways of doing that. But
These are large questions. Of course, I think that there's every reason to be skeptical that in the United States, government provision of health care does a really good job. As I'm sure you know, there was a very interesting exercise called the Oregon Medicaid experiment. What they did was they found two groups of people, and they gave one group of them Medicaid coverage, and the other group did not have Medicaid coverage. And what they found after several years was that there was no discernible health difference between the experiment group and the control group. Now, ordinarily, you wouldn't be able to do something like this because it would raise severe ethical questions. But in fact, they only had so much money, and they could only give half this population health care. And what they found was that, again, there was no physical health difference in the health statistics they dug up. There was some there were different different reports in terms of the happiness of the two groups, because I think this probably had a lot to do with people being panicked that they might have some sort of health event where they'd essentially go bankrupt because of healthcare expenses. There was a lot of worry about catastrophic events, I suspect. But the science suggests that we overestimate the effect of Medicaid provision on people's health. And so I think that people tend to overestimate the value of provision of Medicaid services because, again, in the one controlled experiment that we have the data on, the results just aren't there. And so the hodgepodge we have in America of providing people different healthcare services through different arrangements, it's not that bad. It works out pretty well. I'm somewhat sympathetic to some of the things President Obama tried to do with the exchanges, which is to sort of solve the problem that you were talking about, the problem of job lock, the problem of being locked into your job so that you keep your health care coverage. The problem with the Obama exchanges is they have this whole set of disguised subsidies so that it costs more money to buy an insurance policy if you're relatively wealthy than if you're relatively poor. And if we had really transparent health care policies such that, you know, insurance policies could be in a true market, the exchanges are pretty hard to argue against. That's not really what we have today. But I would not want to say that Obamacare was a complete mistake. It has a strong mixture of bad qualities and a weak mixture of some good qualities. But I think when you start talking about the expansion of Medicaid, I think it is very easy to overestimate the value of that on people's actual health.
But I think you can't argue with the natural experiment that was carried out when it came to the state children's health insurance program and the autonomy that states were given to design how children's health insurance was provided. And I think Arkansas is obviously has been a real winner in that. And it there is all kinds of evidence that in terms of kids' ability to read by the end of third grade, a variety of other indicators, that those children's health insurance programs have had where they've been carried out most effectively, and Arkansas is a good case study, has really made a difference for kids.
Now, I agree with Professor Barth on all that. I mean, if we get away from this idol of universal coverage and we say, look, we have a population of people and we're going to try to figure out an efficient way to cover them, that's an approach that has a lot of promises. This whole universal coverage approach, because it gets more and more expensive, the more, you know, when you try to catch that last 10% or that last 1%, this whole idle universal coverage makes things very difficult and very expensive. But sure, if we're going to have piecemeal approaches, there's lots of common ground and lots of ways to say, you know, this is a very efficient way to cover a very large segment of the market. Absolutely.
All right. Well, callers, you're silent. I appreciate getting emails for the shy who don't want to call in, but I would welcome in the waning moments of the show to have some input from our listeners. Again, 501-433-0088. We're talking about the role of government in our lives, and here we go. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to reflect. This is a few conversations ago about those teachers' assistants. I feel like you said you could just get one right off the street. That was pretty harsh. And
well, I don't think that's entirely fair. But go ahead.
A 6-year-old girl. She's had plenty of teachers' assistants that she remember. We keep up with. I know that the quality varies, but I think it's important to have a little bit of experience and not go. I don't know. Important to have a compromise. Somebody says they don't need any experience versus 700 and whatever days. I guess you try to meet in the middle, but come on, don't say no experience. That's just an insult. Thanks.
Well, I want to respond to that by saying, you know, when you have this required training for 730 days a year, that's not the only kind of experience that you have.
Well, Dan, and I mean, 730 days in a year.
730 days it's required to get a job as a teacher assistant. So that's several
if
years
like
worth
to make
of training.
A call, please.
And so, I mean, when I say off the street, you know, there are other kinds of experience as well. I mean, the best kind of job training, in my view, is a previous job. And there are plenty of people who come off the street who have had previous jobs. And I think it's, I mean, let me be belittling for a second. I mean, I think that that's outrageous when government sets a goal of 730 days of training for this job. And I think that there are plenty of people who've had previous jobs who could come in right off the street and do an excellent job as a teacher's assistant. I think it's outrageous for the employment market.
hang on a second.
To deny these people that kind of opportunity.
Yeah, hello?
Go ahead, sir.
Hey, Paul. This is W.J. Monagle, and I've been listening to the program tonight. I want to, I know this is Pledge Week, so I want to pledge $100 in your honor, Paul, to KABF for this Pledge Week. So you got to keep me on the line. That's my...
Hey, W.J., right. It's Jay. How are you?
Hey, great. I just wanted to comment. I know you guys have been talking a lot about EITC, and I don't know if your viewers or your panelists know, but I head up the Central Arkansas EITC Coalition, and we're responsible for the campaign to make the public more aware of the EITC. And the important thing is the free tax filing centers that that pop up around the tax filing season. Sponsored through the Vita sites, through IRS, and then you also have additional sites through AARP and others. And I just know that, you know, there is a great influx of funds from the EITC every year into just the city of Little Rock alone is more than $50 million. And it really is effective in terms of raising certain people's income to above the poverty level. Now, I don't think that anybody is going to say that it removes poverty. It sort of delays it and helps people who are in that situation. And of course, the EITC is a sliding scale. So you have to have income. Earned income is one of your speakers mentioned, but the more you receive an EITC is based upon having children in poverty status and also having low income. So it's a sliding scale. You can get a few hundred dollars up to last year was just under $6,000. So you can understand that, you know, a family that makes $22,000 can boost their income up to $28,000 is phenomenal for that family. Right. But the other thing I want to mention is that, you know, when you have that influx of funds coming into any kind of community, you also have the predators that are waiting right there in line. And the first line of predators on the EITC is the paid tax preparers. And right. They can take anywhere from, you know, a couple hundred dollars to $1,000 out of the pockets of people who are receiving the EITC that really deserve to keep that money in their own pockets.
Hey, WJ, you paid $100 for this, but we've got to end in 30 seconds. So,
okay. Well, I just want to say that the second and third line is the furniture sellers and the autos auto sellers. The
right.
Secondhand.
Okay. All right.
Just watch out for that, and keep doing what you're doing. Support EITC, and I appreciate what you're doing tonight, Paul, with this topic.
All right. Thank you. Thank both of you all.
It's a privilege to be here.
Thank you.
And I think it was a good discussion, and I appreciate the call. So next week we're going to be talking with the mayor, with the police chief, and with Judge Humphrey about the violence in Little Rock and what's going to be proposed or is being proposed for that. So stay tuned next week for Speak Up Arkansas. Thank you for spending some of your evening with us.
Hi, this is Alanis Morissette, and you're listening to KABF 88.3 in Little Rock, the voice of the people.
It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we'll share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, Chewing the Fat with Rex and Paul, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocals@cals.org. This program is presented by the Butler Center for